the mission, we run the crowd loud. Fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want, we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today, our theme is Risks of Global War, U.S. State Department Propaganda, and the U.S.-NATO Agenda. We'll interview author-activist Stephen Lenman in the first part of the program about his book Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. In the second half of the show, we'll speak with Eric Dreitzer, a political analyst and independent journalist of StopImperialism.org, regarding how the civil war in Syria is now turning into a much larger regional war. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's theme is the risks of global war, U.S. State Department propaganda, and the U.S.-NATO agenda. On the first part of the program, we're going to be speaking with author and activist Steve Lenman. We'll be talking with political analyst Eric Dreitzer later in the program. Here is my co-host Peter Phillips to introduce Steve Lenman. Peter?
Steve Lenman is a writer, syndicated columnist, activist, news, TV personality, and radio show host. He has a BA degree from Harvard and an MBA from Wharton. He spent most of his working life as a marketing research analyst and then in a small family business up through 1999. And since then, he's devoted his time to progressive causes, extensive reading, and write on various vital world and national topics. So he's had a number of books out, Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity, How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and the Class War, and the book that we'll be talking somewhat about today, Flashpoints in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Stephen, welcome.
Peter, Mickey, it's really a delight to be on with you. So much to talk about. All these issues, my God. I don't know how I stay calm dealing with these things. Maybe you ask yourselves the same questions.
Oh, indeed, Stephen. We certainly do. It's great to have you back on the program. Let's dive right in here. We did a show when your book Flashpoint in Ukraine came out, and we interviewed Edward Herman. We had Michael Parenti on. We spoke with Cynthia McKinney. And, of course, up front here, I could say that Peter and I and Nolan Higdon actually have a chapter in your book by Clarity Press, Ukraine, Another Step in Capitalism's Global Dominance, where we talk about transnational corporate class and so forth. What led you to put together this book on Ukraine, and specifically, what was the major angle of it? Because it's certainly a different angle than we're seeing in the U.S. press or any NATO country press.
Well, I was very interested in doing something. It really began when I asked my Clarity editor, Diana Collier, is Clarity planning to do anything on Ukraine? And I would imagine that the discussion came up because she jumped on the idea right away and just threw it right back at me and said, would you be interested in editing a book on Ukraine? And I said, well, I hadn't thought of editing, but it really is a good idea. We could get together with a lot of fine people like you, Peter, and you, Mickey, and put together a book explaining to people exactly what's going on in Ukraine and why it's important and why it matters. Because if you stop somebody on the street and you mention Ukraine, probably most people's eyes would glaze over. They wouldn't know what Ukraine was. Oh, is that a country? Well, I didn't realize that, let alone where it is or what's going on there. And yet it really is the case where Ukraine is being used as a dagger by America pointed at Russia's heartland with the danger of serious confrontation between the two countries that could either accidentally or on purpose develop into a war. That's why Ukraine is important.
Stephen, what is the U.S.-NATO agenda around Ukraine and overall?
Well, I think the U.S.-dominated NATO agenda, as I like to put it, Peter, because America funds 75% of the NATO budget. And NATO, of course, an alliance supposedly for defense that's been used consistently for offense since the middle of the 1990s. And most of the U.S. wars other NATO countries participate in. they participate in all of them, directly or indirectly, covertly or whatever. So you've got a war going on, an Obama war going on in Yemen, and Obama's war going on in Donbass in southeastern Ukraine. And you've got other NATO countries that are complicit in these wars in one way or another, are supplying trainers to the Ukrainian troops. One example, sending covert special forces or other elements into countries like Yemen, again, Ukraine, Syria, doing all kinds of subversive things, supporting America's imperial agenda. And the idea for America is to get rid of all independent countries and make America supremely dominant worldwide. And the ultimate objectives are to get rid of the independent Chinese and Russian governments. They're the final frontiers for America. Ukraine is merely a stepping stone, like all the other former Russian republics and the Warsaw Pact countries. Eliminate them one at a time as independent countries. Bring them into the U.S.-NATO orbit. Use them as daggers against Russia. And again, it's a very serious situation.
Isn't it beyond just the U.S.? Aren't we really talking about global capitalism and the transnational corporate class that includes Europeans, the G7, so to speak, that have been meeting and talking about increasing sanctions on Russia?
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. The G7 really is a very strong alliance, but there's a lot of bullying and pressure that goes on. I don't think Europe is as committed to the anti-Russian agenda as America is, Peter and Mickey. I think they go along because they get so much pressure put on them by America. So you have G7 countries get together. It's absurd not to have Russia involved, not to have China involved. How do you leave a country like China out of the leading nations of the world when they get together? It shouldn't be a G7. It should be a G8 or 9. And Russia, Putin places a lot more stock in other venues, the G20, the BRICS countries, where other nations, important nations, India, South Africa, important countries get together and talk about issues that relate to them all. But the idea of mutual cooperation, at least much more so than when the G7 countries get together. But I really wonder just how long the attitude of these European countries will be in bashing Russia, where there really are a lot of loose strains among the European countries, not at all interested in going along with a policy that harms them as well as harming Russia. If they had the kind of relations that they had before with Russia, it helps them economically. It helps them in all ways. And Europe, of course, knows what it's like to have war in its territory, something America has not experienced since the Civil War. And no living American has any idea what war on the mainland of America would be like. But Europeans know, and many still alive remember World War II.
We're speaking with author and political analyst Stephen Lenman. He has written and edited several books. One of the more recent ones was Flashpoint in Ukraine. We're talking about that now, how U.S. drive for hegemony risks World War III. And Stephen Lenman, it's almost as if we haven't ended the Cold War. It's like a Cold War redux or Cold War 2.0. And a couple of the stories that we have covered, perhaps you can comment on there. Nafis Ahmed did a story, Ukraine Crisis and the Great Power Oil Gas Pipeline issue. Stephen Cohen wrote a piece on distorting Russia. Robert Perry wrote about the staggering hypocrisy in the U.S. on this. All of this is kind of related, and it led Nafis Ahmed to say, well, maybe the Cold War hasn't ended.
I would say the Cold War didn't begin at the end of World War II. It began in 1917. It was really a hot war for a while when Woodrow Wilson sent about 6,000 or 8,000 U.S. Marines to fight the Bolsheviks in 1917. So America has really been in conflict with the Russian system going back all that time. And, of course, we needed Russia during World War II fighting the Nazis. And America didn't liberate Europe. Russians liberated Europe. And America and the EU countries didn't have the decency, the common courtesy, to show up on May 9th for the 70th anniversary of Victory Day in Europe, the war that Russia won. And if it hadn't been for Russia's involvement and contribution to that war on the European mainland, Hitler might have won the war instead of the Allies. But the media very definitely is a major, major issue. I can't remember anything in all the time that I follow the media to have seen anything as outrageous in the misreporting on the Ukrainian story. With the way blatant lies are told and the truths are so obvious, polar opposite, the stuff that comes through the major media all the time, all of it, it's not just television with Fox and CBS and NBC and the rest of them, but the New York Times and Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, especially the editorial pages, just the blatant lying. And all of these people know what's going on. They know the truth, and yet they march in lockstep with America's imperial agenda with the risk of possibly having something very, very major and adverse develop.
Well, Stephen Cohen, who we have in our 2015 book at Project Censored, wrote, "American media on Russia today are less objective, less balanced, more conformist, and scarcely less ideological than when they covered Soviet Russia during the Cold War."
We get the outrageous reports that are exactly the opposite of what's going on. And I honestly, with all the propaganda that I remember, and it's been pretty bad, and I think the propaganda in Ukraine is worse than I've seen on anything. Of course, in the run-up to the Iraq War and the propaganda against Syria and so on, it's pretty ugly in all of it. But the sustained propaganda against Russia, which began before the Ukraine crisis, it's so intense and so bad. The so-called reset was more fiction than fact. But as long as Putin as president of Russia, the bashing goes on.
Certainly the Russia bashing around the Ukraine has centered around the idea that Russia has invaded the Ukraine, that they are back seeking global power by acquiring more land, sort of like a bringing back of the Iron Curtain mentality. Did Russia invade the Ukraine, Stephen?
Russia did not invade Ukraine. The way, quote-unquote, I've seen it so many times, quote, Russian aggression, unquote. The article I just put out on Kiev renouncing the second Minsk agreement, an outrageous statement was made by the authorities in Kiev that Russia took control of 169 Ukrainian municipalities. I don't know how they come up with numbers like that, and I'm not even certain what they call a municipality, a little village, a city, a town, whatever, but Russia has taken control of nothing, and the Crimean situation was so distorted by the Ukrainian officials, U.S. officials, the major media, where Russia did not annex Crimea. The Crimeans voted by national referendum, independently monitored, judged open, free, and fair. And in the UN Charter, it states that self-determination is a universal right, not exactly in those words, but that's the meaning of it. And all Crimeans did was exercise the self-determination. The fact that Crimea was part of Ukraine, made by Nikita Khrushchev in 1954, that was considered an historic mistake. The mistake was corrected. The Crimeans voted, and Putin merely accommodated their wishes, which was the right thing to do.
We're speaking with political analyst and author Stephen Lenman. Of the many books you have, the one we're discussing now is Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. This book came out in spring of 2014, and of course, Project Censored was writing about Ukraine at the time. Stephen, this story that I wanted to bring up came about after your book and our book were already to press. Your book was out. Our book was already at the publisher at Seven Stories Press. This is, again, one of the main catalyzing events in this volley of propaganda between the United States and Russia concerning the downing of the Malaysian passenger airliner MH17. That was on July 17, 2014, killing all 298 people aboard. And if you recall, of course, and I know you do, that the U.S. immediately blamed Russia, and they denied involvement. And journalist Robert Perry had written that German intelligence reports cleared the Russians of any involvement or wrongdoing. Yet the propaganda continued, and there have been several stories drifting around. One thing that's interesting about the German intelligence report is that the United States propounded repeatedly that the Russians were responsible until the German intel report, and then after that, they kind of fizzled, and Washington went quiet on the affair.
Well, Russia, of course, had nothing to do with it, Mickey. And the most obvious question that should be asked right at the top of any discussion of downing MH17 is, qui bono? I mean, who benefits by something like this? What on earth could Russia possibly gain by downing a commercial airliner anywhere, let alone over Ukrainian territory? What could the Donbass freedom fighters gain by downing a commercial airliner? What could Washington gain? What could Kiev gain? What could Britain gain? Well, I think the answer is pretty clear there. They could gain a lot by blaming Russia irresponsibly for something that Russia didn't do. And the story gets more holes shot into it as more evidence comes out. There was other evidence produced by a Malaysian newspaper saying that, I believe it was 30-millimeter cannon fire downing the plane. And there were eyewitnesses reporting a Ukrainian military aircraft, a jet aircraft, trailing the commercial airliner not too far behind when the incident took place. My personal feeling is a Ukraine warplane down MH17, but there certainly is no evidence indicating Russia did it.
Well, that's correct, Steve. There was a Ukrainian jet fighter that was seen there. The point is that the evidence seems to strongly say that Russia did not do this, and then that story fizzled. And then they kind of move on to the next propaganda narrative, right? It's almost as if they just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Exactly. That's exactly what they do. They beat a dead horse to death, beat it some more as long as they can, and when there's nothing left to beat, they'll move on to the next propaganda piece. That's exactly right. And when nothing exists, they just go about inventing it, and that happens time and again.
Stephen Lenman, it is also interesting that, you know, the U.S. was so desperate in trying to demonize Russia. This led to some pretty outrageous statements. Secretary of State John Kerry criticized Russia on numerous points. He was pointing out the illegality of any country acquiring, quote, part or all of another state's territory through coercion or force. This is John Kerry talking. When the United States invaded and occupied Afghanistan, Iraq, it was behind a coup in Honduras, two failed coups in Venezuela. I mean, and then the U.S. State Department spokesperson, Jen Psaki, went so far as saying, quote, as a matter of longstanding policy, the United States does not support political transitions by non-constitutional means. Political transitions must be democratic, constitutional, peaceful, and legal. I mean, is that what Victoria Nuland meant about the $5 billion in the Ukraine, the backing of neo-Nazis? I mean, this is a crazy narrative.
It's so shocking, Mickey, that this stuff is out there and so obvious, and yet the major media go way out of their way to avoid pointing out that, again, the most obvious things in the world. No country in world history is a greater aggressor, a greater threat to world peace, a greater human rights violator on a global scale than America. And whether it's John Kerry, Victoria Nuland, or any of the other people, Marie Harf at the State Department, Jen Psaki before her, spewing these big, big lies, time and again, through all of the sessions, all of the discussions in response to reporters or simply issuing statements, it's outrageous. The lies are so obvious, and the truth is the opposite of what they say, again, is so obvious as well. Anybody could find it out, Mickey. When I was a kid growing up, we didn't have computers, so, you know, you had to rely on the radio and newspapers and then television. But anybody with a computer could so easily find out the truth with a minimal of effort, 10, 15 minutes a day. You can know what's going on in the world in major issues, and just forget about the major media and the lies that they put out. Just tune them out.
Steve Lenman, there's a lot in the media about the TPP and the hidden negotiations, the chapters. A few of them are now being leaked. The idea of these are, of course, that corporations will be further empowered beyond nation state. And this is what we're really talking about, is transnational global capital and corporations with power that supersede nation states. And part of that superseding is a total war agenda that balkanizes the world into small little units of controlled labor that corporations can run roughshod over, literally control. They can even hire private mercenaries to do their business. So this is a whole new world order that we're talking about here, and it's not about the U.S. Capitalism versus socialism. It's really about international capital at the highest levels, at the corporate level, dominating nation states' capitalism and the rights of individual nations. So it changes the entire landscape of the world. And one aspect of war or permanent war is that it's very profitable. Transnational corporations make money from war. It's also solves the problem of overaccumulation of capital at the highest level. As capital is concentrated, it needs to be spent, and it needs to be a return on it. So loaning capital to governments, of course, gives the a return on that and uses up some of the excess capital, and it continues to increase the wealth of the top 0.001% in the world. Do you see that agenda manifesting itself totally in the world today?
Well, these two bills, these major trade bills that are being considered, and I fear they may end up being enacted, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic counterpart to that bill, TTIP, corporate bills, abolishing national laws, putting profits is the only objective that these bills address, individual rights, consumer rights, again, national sovereignty, national laws, they're all overridden. The only underlying objective is making money. Where corporations already run the world, Peter and Mickey, but you pass legislation like this, and they really are just super empowered to do whatever they want and run roughshod over personal freedoms and make the world a lot less livable than it is today. It's outrageous, and a guy like Obama, a serial liar, making statements about how much good these bills can do, talking mainly about TPP, that's the one at the forefront right now. What Europe will do is still a little bit up for grabs. People in Europe are much more vocal than they are in this country. People go out in the streets and protest. I don't know. Have there been protests in America protesting TPP? I mean, if there have been, they're certainly not as vocal as what's going on in Europe.
Stephen Lenman, could you give your blog address, your website address for our listeners so they can go and see some of the things that you're writing about? I mean, you know, I remember once upon a time you were cranking out a couple articles a day, but certainly a prolific amount of information, nearly none of which is in the corporate news media. And again, not even in some of the left progressive press, a lot of the views there. I think a lot of people take it that when we're talking about criticisms of U.S. NATO vis-a-vis Ukraine and the propaganda against Putin, some people hear that as a pro-Putin kind of rhetoric, I think that's black and white, and that's overly simplified. And you've certainly pointed that out in a lot of your writing. So what's a website people can go to?
The easiest way to access my blog site is simply my last name, Lendman. There aren't many Lendmans around. Simply Google my last name. You'll go right to the site. You'll see my articles and other information on it, my books and so on, and it's all there. New information going up all the time.
And it's Stephen with a PH, so it's Stephen with a PH. The book we're discussing here, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. It's out on Clarity Press. It's from last year. And Stephen, you know, you've collected a really impressive amount of work here. The Economist, Michael Hudson, Paul Craig Roberts, Michael Parenti, Project Censored has a chapter in here, Cynthia McKinney, Michelle Chozadovsky, Matthew Witt, Edward Herman, and David Peterson have a great chapter on Ukraine crisis and the propaganda system and overdrive. Robert Abley, colleague of mine at Diablo Valley College on the norms of justice, international law, and duty to protect. That's also very important given, the general director of International Institute of Strategic Studies, you know, was talking about U.S. Congress about how there's some moral obligation and strategic duty to provide Ukraine with increased means to defend itself. That's, again, pretty timely, these kinds of views. And again, you have them covered. A lot of these ideas you have covered in here, of course, James Petras, John McMurdy. It's a really hearty volume, jam-packed with information that you're not going to see in the corporate press, and quite a bit of it you're not going to see even in the left progressive press in the United States. Is that right, Stephen Lenman?
Oh, absolutely. I was so thrilled with being able to get a lineup of people like that, including you, Mickey, and you, Peter, and put together a book. And we put it together in about 2 months. It really was. I thought it was remarkable that the idea was just thrown out of the table, grabbed by Clarity Press, and went to work on it and put it together with about 22 chapters in it. And I felt so honored to be able to be a contributor to the book, along with such an all-star lineup as people like both of you, that it really was very special to me. Another important contributor, Stop NATO's Rick Rozoff, who contributed a chapter to the book. I think all of the information is extremely important, and even though the book is a year old, the information is very, very timely, given what's going on right now.
Well, Stephen Lindman, we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to discuss U.S.-NATO agendas vis-a-vis Ukraine. Again, you are editor of Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. You've also written extensively about how Wall Street fleeces America and banker occupation. So keep up the wonderful work. And again, thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you, Peter.
We've just been speaking with author Stephen Lindman. And after this break, we'll be back with Eric Dreitzer speaking about politics in the Middle East and Ukraine. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's show, Risks of Global War, U.S. State Department Propaganda, and the U.S.-NATO Agenda. We just completed a discussion with journalist and analyst Stephen Lindman focusing on Ukraine, and we're joined now by Eric Dreitzer. Dreitzer is an independent political analyst, editor of StopImperialism.org, and host of Counterpunch Radio. His work focuses primarily on geopolitics and the role of imperialism in the modern world. Dreitzer's articles have appeared in many publications both in the U.S. and internationally and have been translated into more than a dozen languages. He's a regular contributor to Counterpunch, Russia Today, Truthout, and a variety of other media outlets. He is based in New York City. Eric Dreitzer, you join us today by phone.
Thanks for having me.
Eric, we've seen the G7 leaders escalate the threats against Russia. The U.S. has announced that 450 new trainers or military personnel will be added into Iraq. And Rumsfeld actually admits that Bush was wrong about Iraq, trying to make them a democracy. So there's quite a bit sort of shaping up here. And you have an article out, did the war in Syria just become a regional war? So let's talk about that. The overall violence that's occurring, not only in Syria, but in Iraq, in the entire region, what does that say about where we are today?
Well, I think taken from the broadest perspective, it says that where we are today is perhaps the most dangerous phase of this entire conflict. And when I say conflict, I really mean going back to at least 2003, when the United States waged its illegal war against Iraq, the second war against Iraq. And I think that all throughout that period, you know, there was a mentality that this war was really confined to Iraq, that it was U.S. adventurism, and that it was the Bush administration, and that when Obama came to power, somehow that was winding down. But really what we've seen essentially since 2011 and the inception of the so-called Arab Spring has been essentially a series of conflicts culminating in what I think is one of the most dangerous conflicts today, that is the war on Syria. And I think it's important to note here that when I say the war on Syria, I mean an international war, one with an international scope. This is not what the Western media reports it as, which is this vaguely defined civil war between the government of Bashar al-Assad and some sort of moderate opposition. That is farcical. That is a complete distortion of the reality. The truth is that the war has been waged on Syria by a number of regional actors, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others, at the behest of the West, that is the United States, the British, the French to a large extent as well, and then, of course, their regional ally, Israel. And we could go through a long list of documented evidence that shows the support that those countries have given to the radical elements, the jihadi factions that we all know, that we hear in the news every day, from the Al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front to the Islamic State, ISIS, whatever we're calling them. All of these groups, they have international backing, and they really take on an international scope. And I think that that's really the way that it needs to be understood. And of course, as anybody who's been following the ISIS story understands perfectly well, it's not confined to Syria, because ISIS is absolutely the fundamental part of what is happening in Iraq. And when Obama comes out publicly saying that he's going to send 450 trainers into Iraq, I think the first question that any reasonable skeptic should ask is, where are those trainers going? who are they going to be training? Because certainly the United States has done everything it can in the last 6 months to a year to undercut the Iraqi military, because it sees the Iraqi military as connected far too closely with Iran. And so what they've actually done is subverted the attempts by Baghdad's central government to curtail the terrorist activity. And they've been attempting to foment the conflict by providing arms, weapons, and training to these so-called Sunni militias. But I think, as I said, a skeptical perspective on that would ask, who exactly are these Sunni militias? Who are these Kurdish militias? And whose agenda are they really executing? I think from a realistic and pragmatic perspective, what the United States is doing, it is fracturing Iraq. It is fomenting conflicts, sectarian, ethnic, political, military conflicts within the body politic of Iraq, just as it's attempted to do in Syria, for the purposes of more or less being able to manage the chaos that it has unleashed throughout the region. And managed chaos, I think, is a central tenet of U.S. imperial strategy.
So chaos theory, which has been written about in a number of circles now for a few years, sees the one of the U.S. agendas and or the transnational state agenda of the G7 as allowing for chaos in regions not only the Middle East but perhaps Africa as well, where resources are coveted by the imperial powers, and so their powerful militaries, their capabilities, allow for a weakened states, a balkanization of all of these regions for an interpenetration of capital. Is that kind of what you mean by chaos theory?
Exactly. And I don't mean to suggest that that's always the number one objective, because, of course, what the United States and its allies attempt to do most often, more often than not, is to institute as clean of a possible regime change as they can. So you could take as a template what happened in Libya. The United States and its allies, the NATO alliance, foments a war based on trumped up charges against a country and a government that it sees as a political and a geopolitical obstacle. And it uses terrorist elements and various al-Qaeda-linked groups and other nefarious factions in order to essentially carry out a regime change as quickly, cleanly, and efficiently as possible. And ultimately, that is what happened in Libya. And anybody who's followed that war and the disastrous outcome of it understands perfectly well that that's exactly how it happened. In Syria, there was an attempt to do something similar, but unlike in Libya, in Syria, the regime change attempt has been a failure. They have not been able, over the course of more than 4 years, to oust President Assad. If anything, they have galvanized his support to a large extent. They have essentially waged an international campaign against the legitimate government of Syria, no matter what you think of it. And ultimately, what's happened then is they've been unable to institute a clean and quick regime change. And so it seems that they have defaulted to a secondary option, which is what I mentioned, the managed chaos strategy. If they can't cleanly and efficiently oust Assad, well, then bust up the country as much as possible, unleash the death squads, create chaos, sow division, sectarian, religious, ethnic, political, military, and otherwise, and thereby collapse the state. And by collapsing the state and collapsing the government, they can ultimately achieve some of their main objectives. And, I mean, if we have time to go through it, I can list a whole litany of their objectives as it regards to Syria, not the least of which, of course, being breaking the alliance of resistance that exists between Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. And actually, Iraq was a part of that alliance as well when it was led by former Prime Minister Maliki, who had close allegiances to the Iranians. And so breaking that arc of alliances was one of the central principles of what the United States wanted to do. And I think that that still remains part of the strategy in Syria. Also, of course, blocking the potential pipeline, which had been proposed in 2011, that would have brought Iranian and Iraqi energy exports to the Syrian Mediterranean coast and thereby giving them access to the European market. Of course, Qatar and the Saudis were tremendously fearful of that competition. So there was an economic perspective, an economic motivation, political motivation, geopolitical motivation, and then from the broadest perspective, depriving Russia of its last remaining ally in the Middle East, in Syria. So many different facets all coming together to demonstrate, I think, quite obviously, that Syria and the war against Syria is an internationally orchestrated war for the purposes of the political and geopolitical agenda of the empire.
We're speaking with Eric Dreitzer, political analyst, independent journalist from StopImperialism.org. Eric Dreitzer, that was, again, a concise but detailed sort of history of a lot of the powers and the forces and the conflicts in the region, the stirring up of the region by U.S. NATO powers. You mentioned Russia. We want to come back to Russia and Ukraine in a little while. We were speaking earlier on the program about that. But you write in your recent article, you write about the so-called Turkish gambit. I wanted to start here. You write in 2012, the New York Times, which, by the way, of course, as we know, the New York Times is normally catapulting, you know, various degrees of propaganda, you know, against the Libyan government, the Syrian government, the Russian government, and so forth. The New York Times confirmed that the CIA was busily funneling weapons into the hands of anti-Assad forces from the Turkish side of the border, using connections with Muslim Brotherhood. Let's just go into that and a little bit of the background of Islamic State. This is, again, more evidence now confirmed here, of course, by the so-called paper of record, that there's a lot behind the scenes happening to destabilize this region.
That's exactly right. And I remember writing about it back in 2012 when this report came out. Now, of course, at that time, they had confirmed what I and many others were saying already since the very beginning of this conflict, that there was never a so-called revolution or uprising in Syria, that this was an international destabilization campaign. And that really just continued to confirm that aspect of it. Now, of course, there were domestic political reasons for various forms of discontent in Syria, but it was never a regime change operation until the United States and the Western powers got involved in it. And so in 2012, when the New York Times confirmed that the CIA was working with their longtime allies, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, to funnel these weapons in, it became clear that Turkey essentially had made itself into a hotbed, into a locus of this destabilization campaign. And it wasn't just the funneling of weapons, arms, and financing from the U.S., of course. There was a report from Reuters also in 2012, which documented terrorist training camps near the Turkish city of Adana. Now, think for a second. If anyone is clear about Turkish geography, the city of Adana is within a short driving distance of one of the main NATO bases in anywhere in the European or Eurasian space. That is the NATO base at Incirlik. Now, it takes a tremendous amount of obliviousness and I think naivete to believe that the U.S. and NATO forces that were at the Incirlik base had no idea that there was a base, a training center right nearby that was a hotbed of the terrorist activity that was penetrating into Syria. I think that what became clear even in 2012 was the scope of this international campaign and the very nefarious role that Turkey was playing. And I think that part of the reason why it's so difficult to grasp is because people don't have an understanding of what the Turkish agenda in Syria is, because Erdogan and the Turkish government sees in Assad an obstacle, a tremendous obstacle to the projection of their power. They see themselves in a quote-unquote neo-Ottoman light, that is to say, abandoning the 20th century history of Turkish nationalism, Turkish sovereignty, Turkey recognizing its own borders and focusing only on itself, and rather reverting back to the Ottoman legacy of projecting Turkish power throughout the region. That is essentially a fundamental tenet of the Erdogan Davutoglu, who just recently resigned a few days ago, strategy in the region. And they saw the overthrow of Assad as really a stepping stone to the projection of Turkish power. And that is part of the reason why they made themselves into this fundamental aspect of the war against Syria. And we've seen countless times from 2011, 2012, up until today, where Turkey has done this. We have reports of Turkish military incursions into the northwestern Syrian city of Idlib, Turkish military helicopters providing air and ground support for al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State factions that have been fighting in that region in the last 2 years. I mean, you have direct collusion between Turkish intelligence bringing weapons into the country in order to put them into the hands of the most radical Islamic State extremists who theoretically we're supposed to be fighting against. So there is this collusion happening behind the scenes, and you know, it's even been exposed in Turkish media, and the Cumhuriyet, the news outlet that actually broke this story, their editor-in-chief is now facing a potential life sentence that Erdogan, the president of Turkey himself, called for precisely because he exposed the nefarious role that Turkey has played in fomenting the war in Syria.
We're speaking with political analyst Eric Dreitzer, StopImperialism.org, a recent article at Counterpunch.org. Did the war in Syria just become a regional war? So you can see more there at Counterpunch.org. Learn more about Eric Dreitzer at StopImperialism.org. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Eric Dreitzer, you mentioned, or I actually mentioned in the article that you brought up, and we just talked around it very quickly, the Muslim Brotherhood here. Is there any connection to what was going on here with this in Egypt? And what do you say about analysts that look at the region in terms of the Arab Spring narrative or frame in terms of there being actual pro-democratic or pro-independence movements on the ground in these countries that are kind of stuck between these factions?
Well, it's a complicated question. To take the first part of that, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood and the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood are intimately connected. And those people who say that, oh, they're two completely different organizations, this is complete obfuscation, they are connected. The difference is that the Muslim Brotherhood, which had been suppressed for many years in Egypt, functioned as a political machine. It had a political grassroots movement that was rooted in what you might call the petit bourgeoisie of Egypt, the shopkeeper merchant class. That's why they have tremendous influence in the Egyptian expat community around the West. In contrast, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, anybody who knows recent Syrian history knows, was completely eradicated or almost completely eradicated by Bashar Assad's father, Hafez Assad, in 1982, particularly in the city of Hama. Now, that's held against Assad as a tremendous massacre, and certainly it was violent bloodletting. There's no doubt about that. But what happened in Syria was that the Muslim Brotherhood was essentially eradicated, and the remnants of the Muslim Brotherhood fled into Turkey, and they fled abroad. And so when we say that in 2011 and 2012, the CIA was working with the Muslim Brotherhood to funnel weapons, and what they're talking about is with those same networks that they've had, that they've maintained relationship with over multiple decades for the purposes of instituting regime change against Assad's son, Bashar Assad, who's been leading Syria now for a decade and a half. And so you see then that there is actually a historical trajectory that has brought us to this point. Now, as far as the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and the notion of the Arab Spring, this is, I think, a misnomer, because what the Western media narrative wants to portray is some sort of a cohesive movement happening around the Arab world, where you have some kind of a democracy upsurge, pro-democracy movement in order to get rid of a brutal dictator. But interesting to note, only in certain places is that deemed legitimate. For instance, in the country of Bahrain, ground zero of the Arab Spring, the United States had no interest in supporting the true democratic aspirations of the vast majority of the people there, who are Shia and who are ruled over by the Al Khalifa royal family. And that uprising was put down violently by force by the Saudis, the U.S. ally. So in the case of Bahrain, where it was politically expedient for the United States to maintain the status quo, there was no Arab Spring. However, in a country like Libya, for example, which they attempted to frame as a democratic upsurge, they needed to get rid of Gaddafi. So they called it Arab Spring, democratic aspirations, the people of Benghazi, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, what I'm saying is that this term Arab Spring is actually a convenient political tool. It is a propaganda term for the purposes of framing the nature of the narrative. And that is, I think, how the Arab Spring needs to be understood. I think that it is essentially a public relations gambit more than it is a true political movement. Now, certainly, in each of these countries, there were various discontents, various factions who had issues and grievances over representation, issues over economic questions, and many other things. But this is the nature of all states, of all societies. What we're talking about instead is essentially a continuous regime change strategy that the United States and its allies were employing for the purposes of extending their hegemony in the region. And, I mean, you can have a direct connection here also with the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood sweeps into power in Egypt on the back of the so-called Arab Spring, only to find that they are a reactionary force that is supporting the war against Syria, supporting the various reactionary elements in Qatar who have bankrolled the Muslim Brotherhood. So the politics get very murky, and I think that Westerners have a tendency to oversimplify all of this and say, well, there's the good guys who talk about democracy, and there's the bad guys who are dictators, which is not the reality. That's not how politics actually works, and that's certainly not how the imperialists who are orchestrating this think.
Eric, Rumsfeld was interviewed at the New York Times, and he talked about how he admits that Bush was wrong about Iraq, trying to bring democracy forward there. But he says that the UN and NATO are no longer capable of coping with these modern threats, and that we need a coalition of right-thinking nations from across the globe. What's he talking about?
What he's really talking about is that they were unable to institute a compliant puppet government in Iraq. It has nothing to do with democracy. It was never about democracy. What it was about was creating a situation in Iraq where the United States could dictate the political fate of that country, could dictate the economic fate of the people of that country, and so forth. And that's really what they were unable to do. Let's remember back, those of us who were following closely the situation in Iraq, the neocons, the Bush administration, they wanted to put their man on Ahmed Chalabi in power. That was a failure. Then they attempted to get Ayad Alawi into power. That was a failure. And they ended up with Prime Minister Maliki, who they hated primarily because Maliki was close to the Iranians. He represented the majority of the people, that is the Shia ethnic group, the Shia religious faction. And he also was unwilling to allow the United States permanent military bases and a permanent military presence. And so you see that when Obama takes credit for withdrawing U.S. troops out of Iraq, it was only because he was forced to by the political circumstances that had been brought about by the blundering, warmongering policies of the United States under Bush and Obama. And so when Rumsfeld says that, he's being disingenuous, because what he really means is that they couldn't dictate the situation in Iraq, and that Iran actually gained influence rather than being weakened by those policies. Now, as far as the SEAL Team 6 goes, this is, in some ways, there's interesting information there, but we knew all of this, and it wasn't just SEAL Team 6. We know the Joint Special Operations Group that, made famous by Scahill and the Dirty Wars. We know the CIA and the way that the CIA has operated in political assassinations everywhere from the Congo to, Afghanistan and all over the world. So this is actually part of an even broader system that the United States has employed for decades, and that is essentially covert destabilization and the waging of covert war. When the United States goes to war with its so-called boots on the ground, a really disgusting euphemism that's become part of our lexicon, but when the U.S. goes in with boots on the ground, this is what they like to refer to as war. But in fact, the United States is waging war all over the world using precisely these sorts of tactics. Does anyone doubt that the United States was waging war in Central America in the 1980s? Of course not. Does the United States doubt that, do people doubt that the United States was waging covert wars all over Africa? Of course not. So the SEAL Team 6 issue is really just giving us yet another glimpse of a broader imperial strategy that the U.S. and its allies have employed, using intelligence networks and using special forces for the purposes of regime change and otherwise destabilization in their interests.
We're speaking with political analyst Eric Dreitzer, StopImperialism.org. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Eric Dreitzer, I want to segue from Syria and let's move more toward Ukraine. There are certainly some lineage here. One of the issues, and this is something we talk about on the show often, is the way that media, the corporate media, frame these issues. And we mentioned earlier in the program today with Stephen Lenman about the propaganda. We've seen the same kind of anti-Putin propaganda, the same kind of anti-Qaddafi, anti-Assad propaganda. And again, I mean, that's not to laud any of these characters. And again, as you mentioned, this is not necessarily the easy black and white type of thing. I mean, we can easily criticize U.S. NATO operations without simultaneously ignoring some of the human rights abuses of other people in these regions. But the point is that the U.S. and NATO have been operating, you mentioned the term numerous numerous times under the auspices really of regime change. And we saw that in Ukraine. We've seen some extraordinary degrees of hypocrisy in Ukraine, statements coming out of the White House and the State Department and so on. This is, again, all very, very alarming. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of your thoughts about U.S. actions in Ukraine. Again, there's almost no discussion here in the U.S. about support of the neo-Nazis. You and I spoke earlier about some of the stories happening in Ukraine that are almost totally blacked out by the Western press. I just wanted to hear some of your views on what's happening there, because this is also a place that you write a lot about.
I'll talk about that, but I want to put it in the context of what we've just been talking about. The reason why I focus so heavily on places like Syria and Ukraine is because these are conflicts that are not really local conflicts. These are regional and conflicts with global implications. There are various powers at play in a war in Syria, just as there are tremendous powers at play in Ukraine, actually some of the most dangerous powers at play, because you have the imperial hegemon, the United States, and it's the system that it leads in confrontation, in direct confrontation with Russia, which, of course, as everybody knows, is a nuclear power, though not the superpower that it perhaps once was, as the Soviet Union. So the stakes could not possibly be higher in a place like Ukraine. So for an analyst who is interested in questions of imperialism and global conflict, I mean, this is really where the action is, and that's one of the reasons why we have to focus on it. Now, as far as the narrative, I mean, essentially, it's been completely distorted from the very beginning. This was framed as a yet another democratic upsurge, which it never really was. The question was always as to whether or not the hegemony that would be exerted over Ukraine's political and economic future would be a Western, that is U.S. and European hegemony, or whether Ukraine would stay as it traditionally has been within the Russian sphere of influence. And this was ultimately what the conflict was about, and those are not necessarily my words. You can take John Mearsheimer's writing in Foreign Affairs, Stephen Cohen, many others have written exactly about that point, and that is really the crux of the conflict. And so instead of the media covering it in that way, in an honest and objective sense, what they instead did was they created a false narrative in which the United States, as it always is the promoter of democracy, democratic aspirations, human rights, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's big bad Russia, the evil villain of yesteryear, which comes in with its imperial revanchist ideology, which is, of course, utterly absurd. Now, there are practical reasons for some of the events that have happened that have led us to this point. I think one of the ones that's most often cited, and I think in an utterly dishonest way, is the annexation of Crimea by Russia in March of 2014. What they say essentially is that Russia, in its imperial lust for power, seized Crimea away from Ukraine, when in fact what happened was the United States sponsored a regime change operation, took one government out, put a hand-picked puppet government in place, and the Russians saw that half of their navy, based in the city of Sevastopol in Crimea, was in danger of now becoming part of a hostile country. And this is, of course, strategically and militarily absolutely critical, and any true military analyst would tell you that Russia acted in the way that any power would act in that situation. That is to say, they moved quickly to secure their naval assets. This is an element that is absolutely ignored entirely in the mainstream narrative. They don't even discuss it as if Russia never had a Black Sea fleet in Sevastopol for two centuries, as if that's not part of this entire narrative. And I think that this is just one example of the dishonesty and the myopic sort of view of the New York Times and the Washington Post and all of the other propagandists. They don't want to talk about that because they don't want to frame this as Russia acting in a pragmatic way. They want to frame it as Russia acting in a belligerent way. And the reason for that, ultimately, from the broadest perspective, is because that justifies their 25-year policy of NATO expansion. Remember, at the end of the Soviet Union, at the end of the Cold War, there was an agreement that was reached between the United States and the Soviet Union with George H.W. Bush and Gorbachev that if the Soviets allowed for the Berlin Wall to come down and for the dismantling, essentially, of the Eastern Bloc, they were guaranteed that NATO would not move eastward. And almost immediately, that's exactly what happened. NATO absorbed the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. NATO absorbed Poland. NATO began to absorb other countries in Eastern Europe from the former Soviet bloc. And Russia at the time, being politically and economically economically and socially in disarray, was essentially powerless to stop all of that. And I think the principal example of that would be the war on Yugoslavia, a war that was sponsored by a democratic president in the United States, lauded by liberals as a humanitarian operation, and Russia was unable to block any of that. And we've seen what's happened since then, the Balkanization of the Balkans, the creation of all of these conflicts that still continue today. And Russia has essentially drawn a line in Ukraine saying you're not going to do what you did to Yugoslavia to Ukraine, which is a Russian historical territory where they speak Russian, they have a shared Russian history, and so forth, and B, is directly on Russia's border and militarily and strategically critical to Russian national security. And it is the drawing of that line, the resistance that Russia has shown to this imperial project, that has made it once again into the ultimate villain. And I guess from that broad geopolitical perspective, that's how all of this events in Ukraine need to be understood. And the line in eastern Ukraine, which has now grown into this civil war, that is part of this, because of course these people in eastern Ukraine, they don't speak Ukrainian, they speak Russian. Their history is a Russian history. They are in the industrial heartland of that country. Their history is one of the Soviet history, not of Western Ukrainian history. And these divisions, ethnic, linguistic, religious, cultural divisions, these have all been exacerbated by this regime change operation carried out by the United States. But of course, none of that is part of the Western narrative, because it complicates the matter and it illustrates what the U.S. has been doing all along.
Well, Eric Dreitzer, we're almost out of time, but I did want to at least note that, you know, however corrupt the Ukrainian government was prior to the coup, which was supported by some of the Nazi elements, I mean, the government there now was recognized by the United States as technically an illegal government, particularly when the United States is lecturing Russia about illegal occupations and so forth as part of their relentless propaganda campaign. But I also wanted to mention that just after the coup, Joe Biden's son Hunter Biden was hired at Burisma Holdings, the largest natural gas company in Ukraine. The IMF $17 billion loan to Ukraine came with strings attached from Monsanto. I mean, again, this is part of that transnational capitalist class that Peter Phillips has talked about in our books. I mean, this is, again, a real element of what's happening in Ukraine.
Absolutely. It's a fundamental part of what's happening in Ukraine. The debt servitude that they're creating through the IMF and through the international financial institutions, the collapse of their currency, the collapse of their economy, this is all part of the same strategy that we saw in the 1990s with Russia, isn't it? I mean, essentially, they're collapsing the country, collapsing its economy, and being able to sell it off for scraps for tremendous profits for themselves and their corporate cronies. I would also point out one other angle that is just never discussed in the narrative, or almost never discussed, and that's the role of Nazis and fascists. And the United States has a very sordid history supporting fascists, whether we're talking about in Central America, whether we're talking about in the former Yugoslavia, whether we're talking about in the former Soviet space. The United States is doing it once again. And I can tell you from my own personal history, if my family comes from that exact region of Ukraine, the history of fascist pogroms, the history of fascism is still runs very, very deep for the people of the eastern Ukraine. And when they see Right Sector and the Svoboda Party and all of these extreme Nazi elements, the Azov Battalion and others, when they see them normalized as part of the Kiev-sponsored Ukrainian military, to them, this is an act of war. So those people in the eastern Ukraine, far from being the quote-unquote pro-Russian separatists, the pro-Russian puppets or whatever the West wants to call them, these are people who have organized themselves for self-defense. They've organized themselves to defend their homes, their families, their communities from what they know to be a tremendous existential threat to them and to their history. And if you look at the repressive laws, the attacks on journalists, which is almost never discussed in the West, the attack on minorities, ethnic minorities, linguistic minorities, the outlawing of the Communist Party, one of the most popular parties in the region, all of these things, the normalization of the Nazi history, calling them heroes instead of Nazi collaborators, all of this goes to show that the shattering of Ukraine has now been made permanent because of U.S. and Western policy and the NATO war that they're sponsoring.
Eric Dreitzer, political analyst, independent journalist with StopImperialism.org. Thank you so much for your insights and your perspectives on what's happening in Syria, Ukraine, around the world with Western imperialism. Thanks for joining the Project Censored show today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
We want a liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the United States. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for. Why attacks them while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Divide and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you probably